It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosi.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Sosi. The show is available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. Now, this week, I promise we will get to my archive interview, my 2015 interview with actor-director James Keach, who did the Glenn Campbell documentary, I'll Be Me. Joe Shearer and I got really, really yappy last week, and we just didn't get to it. But I have company in studio. You know who it is.
Lawrence of Arabia. He's an English guy. He came to fight the Turkish.
Okay, Clark, right there. That's what I'm talking about. Lawrence of Arabia doesn't have any lyrics to it. Doesn't have any words.
What do you mean doesn't have lyrics?
It's music. It's music.
Hey, I've seen the movie four times.
And there were no words to it.
What are you
doing? There are no words to that. Did you hear what I was singing earlier?
Somewhere I know that somebody, I think, wrote lyrics to this song.
Mike Perry's here.
I didn't do it. I did not write lyrics to that song.
You would have.
I would have.
If Brian Setzer can add lyrics to instrumentals, then you could actually add to what was already written of Lawrence of Arabia.
Sure, sure.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. And yourself?
Hanging in there. I know it's been kind of busy with going from one play to another, so I haven't been able to watch a whole lot of stuff recently. However, there is some things of note. Go to Heartland. It all, of course, depends on when you're listening to the show. HeartlandFilmFestival.org, because they have the film series about the cultural journey of India. I believe that is finishing up today. September 14th, I got to mention this, at the Butler Arts Center. And I hope I'm saying this right, so pardon my French. Sue George presents The Life Aquatic, a tribute to David Bowie. Oh. So he'll be doing the Life Aquatic soundtrack, which was all, if I remember right, Portuguese David Bowie tunes.
Cool.
That's, there you go, at Butler. See? That's a unique experience here in Indianapolis. So, while I type up this week's film. Like I said before, we'll get to the James Keach thing in a little bit, but I do want to mention there was something new I got to see in theaters, and then you saw something new released in limited theater release, which is right up your alley, and we'll get to that. And yes, we'll talk a little bit about Joseph Bologna. Opening this week, he is out of retirement, because we should never, ever listen to somebody when they say they're going to retire or it's their final tour, their final farewell. But director Steven Soderbergh has a film that's out in August called Logan Lucky. And this is with Channing Tatum and Adam Driver. They are brothers who are going to organize a heist of a NASCAR stadium, of a track. So there's a lot of humor around the West Virginia, North Carolina border. Tatum is down on his luck. He's trying to see his daughter. The ex-wife, played by Katie Holmes, who's moved on, wants to go further. The daughter has a dance a talent contest that's coming up real soon. Nice scenes with, I believe it's Farrah McKenzie, who plays Tatum's daughter. They have some nice chemistry together. And Adam Driver plays Tatum's brother, who is missing a hand, which kind of comes into the plot. Also rounding out the show, Daniel Craig. Daniel Craig with a Southern accent and bleach white hair. He looks like Robert Shaw in From Russia with Love with really, really bad tats.
But just a side note real quick. Thank you, yes. Daniel, for committing. Okay.
Yeah, it is fun to watch him. Seth MacFarlane is in this, as well as Hilary Swank. And with watching the first 10 minutes of this, because it is set in the West Virginia, southern West Virginia, for you geography majors, with the mining and the small towns, and it seems initially like low-hanging fruit. These kind of small-town southern bumpkins. It just happened to be Channing Tatum and Adam Driver. And as you're watching this, you're like, the question comes up, are we really doing a NASCAR version of Ocean's 11? And if Steven Soderbergh were here, he would look you dead in the eye and say, yes. That's all it kind of is. So on paper, you would think, really? He's done three of these already to various degrees of success, 12 notwithstanding. But it works. It works. It is, imagine, instead of take out all the handsome guys and Las Vegas and put in, well, you know, a goateed Channing Tatum and a group of, because there's other folks involved with it. You have your southern versions of Casey Affleck and Scott Kahn, other family members of Daniel Craig's who has to help out. And of course, not everything goes according to plan, but the man knows how to make a heist film. He's done at least three of them. It's written by Rebecca Blunt. I don't think any relation. It's her first film, and it moves along well. Is it in the same ballpark as Ocean's 11? I don't think so, but it moves well. It's got a little bit of humor to it. It does kind of get past some of the what would be easy targets of southern bumpkins. I know it's, I think, Ed Johnsonat, and he's not the first to write. It's a lot of people have been calling it 7-Eleven. But it's for an August movie after a loud summer, you could do a lot worse. It's actually enjoyable.
Cool.
So I think, now, how are you in the marm on the Ocean's films?
I saw the first two. I don't know that I saw the third one.
Third will help cleanse the second.
Will it?
Yeah.
Something would have to.
Right. So anyway, that is out there. And welcome back, Steven Soderbergh. We missed you.
Yes, we did.
You don't have to retire. Keep making films. Because even if they're disappointments, they're interesting.
Yeah.
Because you're Steven
Soderbergh. They're never dull.
Exactly. All right. Now, Mike Perry here, besides being the television correspondent for film and classic TV of film sociology, you saw something in theaters. Tell us about it.
Well, those who know me know, big Batman fan.
Of all kinds.
And this week they released into theaters for one night only the latest animated Batman movie from DC Animation called Batman and Harley Quinn.
Mm-hmm.
Harley Quinn has a very unique history in the DC universe in that she was created for the cartoon series that was out in the 90s after Michael Keaton's Batman came out. They had an animated series that ran on Fox and on the WB.
But that was back when Mark Hamill was voicing the Joker,
yes.
If I'm not right? Well, okay,
yes.
I know a little history. Good.
Yes. And so she was created for the TV show. Just as a one-off, thinking they'll never use her again. Then she got really popular, and now she's in the comic books. And
is it safe to say there hadn't been a female villain in a while when she was created, or at least a new one?
Well, you always had your Catwoman,
and
your Poison Ivy,
right?
Batman had his female villains too, but what Harley brings to the table is comedy.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the funnier Batman movies I've ever seen. The warning to parents when it comes out on Blu-ray, it is PG-13, and they do deal with some rough language and some sexual situations.
I think one
in
that,
a Batman cartoon.
I think there's one that Burt Ward really wants done, and he's still with us.
But they did bring back the original voice talent of Batman and Robin for this movie from the TV series.
Okay.
And Melissa Rauch from The Big Bang Theory. She
and
plays
the Bronze.
Bernadette.
See, I'm intrigued with that because I know she's got a great voice, and I would love to hear her take on this.
Well, she does a very good Arlene Sorkin impression. Arlene Sorkin was the original Harley. Harley Quinn in the cartoon.
Now, for the record, gang, because I remember having to discuss this at Halloween, last Halloween, when I would hear somebody be going as Harley Quinn, I would ask, animated Harley Quinn or Margot Robbie Harley Quinn? Because if you Google image it, and I wouldn't advise that at work, there is a difference.
There is a difference.
Right.
Night and day difference, really.
Right.
The cartoon Harley is a lot of fun.
Giant hammer.
And, you know, and Batman being the most serious person on the planet, even he gets out a one-liner or two in this movie. They throw some winks to the Adam West version in a couple of places. Mm-hmm. It's just... The plot is almost genius in its simplicity. Poison Ivy makes an appearance, and she's out to take over the world and release a virus that will turn us all into plant people because humans are destroying the planet. So if we were all plants, we probably wouldn't do that.
We'd bring more oxygen in, I guess.
So Batman and Nightwing, former Robin Dick Grayson. Yes, I'm that geeky.
That's all right.
They need to enlist the aid of Poison Ivy's BFF, Harley Quinn, to capture her and thwart her evil plan. So it's teaming up with a really crazy villain, and the hijinks ensue. And I'll tell you, I've watched just about every one of the Batman animated features that DC's cranked out over the last 10 years. This is by far one of the more entertaining. Technically, it's crude animation by today's standards.
Okay,
they made it look like the original TV show, and it's written by people who worked on it. And so it has that feel. If you're a fan of the TV series, you will like this movie.
Are you talking? It looks like the look of the original late '80s, early '90s animation, not the '70s animation, which
right.
I actually do remember.
Right.
Okay.
No, this would be the cartoon series that kind of rejuvenated Batman.
Of course.
So if you're a fan of that series, you'll love this movie. There are times where your eyes will roll in the back of your head at some of the situations, that, especially early on in the film. Let's just say Harley and Nightwing kind of get busy.
Oh, my.
And they don't really shy away from that.
Now, is this still lighter than the last one you saw?
Yes, definitely lighter than the last one I saw. I recommend it to any Batman fan or any cartoon fan. And if you liked Harley Quinn in Suicide Squad, check her out in this. It was released on Blu-ray Tuesday, so you probably get it on Netflix pretty soon. Check it out.
There you go. Okay, so you have options, and it's August, and there's still plenty out there. You mentioned a video, good segue, because new on Blu-ray and DVD this week, the new title, Alien Covenant, if you want to see that. Yeah, it's fine. Criterion has put out one of their old titles from 1980, the political espionage comedy Hopscotch.
Oh, cool.
Walter Matthau and Glenda Jackson. Mike Lee's Meantime is also out on home video. Want to head to the drive-in quickly. Okay, here we go. At the Tibbs, screen one. Oh, my gosh. Of course they did. Also opening this weekend is The Hitman's Bodyguard with Samuel L. Jackson and Ryan Reynolds. And, yeah, they did do a poster send-off of The Bodyguard.
They're finally getting around to releasing that. I've been seeing trailers for nearly a year now.
So you have The Hitman's Bodyguard along with the Halle Berry thriller that nobody has seen, Kidnap. Interesting double fill. Screen 2, Logan Lucky along with Megan Levy. It's a lot of flag waving. Screen 3, Annabelle Creation along with Dark Tower. Screen 4, The Nut Job 2, and Girls Trip. All right. You're hoping the kids fall asleep.
There's
by
a trick
one.
I used to use, just a pairing of those movies.
Yeah.
When my daughter was just a youngin', and I'd take her to the Claremont and Deluxe out in Claremont.
Mm-hmm.
Rest in peace. They had two screens, so they'd have the kids' movie on one screen and the more adult movie on the other. Try to get in the middle. Back your car, your truck up to one of them so your kid can look out the back and
you can look out the front
and watch the cartoony movie And then you can watch Annabelle or whatever you.
You said adult, so I'm thinking something else, but yeah, it's fine. Anyway, that is over at the Tibbs, over at the Skyline, Annabelle Creation and Dunkirk. All right. Over at IU Cinema, again, this depends on when you're listening to this show, at 3 o'clock on Saturday the 19th, Ocean Waves from 1993. At 7 p.m. on Saturday, Kiki, the 2016 documentary. Monday the 21st is the part of the President's Choice series at 7 o'clock from 1949, The Fountainhead. Ooh. Still better than all of the Atlas Shrugs put together. Thursday, August 24th. At 7 p.m., a series they're calling Kids These Days, Boys in the Hood. I think you have to be on a front porch when you say that series. So that is the 24th. And then Friday, August 25th, if you're in Bloomington, this is a can't miss. At 6:30 p.m., their staff selection, 1977's brilliant Slapshot.
Oh, cool.
9:30 p.m., Clerks. At midnight, The Princess Bride. That's a triple feature right there.
They're saving The Princess Bride for last?
Apparently. Saturday, August 26th, The Princess Bride at 3 p.m. and Whose Streets at 7 p.m. And over at the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin, Indiana, the 25th and 26th, the All 80s Film Festival. Friday the 25th at 7:30 p.m. Big, 10 p.m. Raising Arizona. Saturday the 26th at 2 p.m. Adventures in Babysitting. 5 p.m. Stand By Me. 7:30 p.m. The Karate Kid. And 10 p.m. Fast Times at Ridgemont High. And then September 8th and 9th at the Art Craft, North by Northwest. September 15th and 16th, Mary Poppins. We just got a couple of minutes before I want to replay my interview with James Keach. But we have a dead person we like because we never have time for dead people we don't like. Actor, writer, and director Joseph Bologna passed away on August 13th at the age of 82nd. Besides being married to Renee Taylor, which gives him major kudos, one of his first screenplay got an Academy Award nomination for Best Adapted Screenplay, the comedy from 1970, Lovers and Other Strangers.
Oh, yeah.
Also wrote films like Made for Each Other, A Cry for Love, Love is All There Is. Of course, appeared in Made for Each Other, as well as 1973's Cops and Robbers, The Big Bus. Probably the thing I best remember him from was playing King Kaiser in My Favorite Year.
Yeah.
A must see for anybody. A great Valentine to 50s television with Peter O'Toole, Mark Lynn Baker. Was a sidekick in Chapter 2, Blame It on Rio, The Woman in Red, Transylvania 6-5000. Yes, he was in Alligator 2, The Mutation. Why wouldn't you? And also Big Daddy in Blink of an Eye. But you know him from a series that predates Cop Rock.
It's about the same era. It was one of TV's many stabs at creating a successful TV musical.
Mm-hmm.
And the name of it was?
I just had it right here. Sorry. Not Top of the Heap. Rags to Riches.
Rags to Riches,
1987
yeah.
to 88.
Yep. It didn't last very long, just a few months, really. But it did kind of leave a mark, one that said, well, maybe we should rethink this whole TV musical thing. But then Cop Rock tried it again a few years later, and really not until recently with My Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
Which my wife and daughter love.
That someone has successfully melded, you know, a weekly TV series and musical comedy.
Would you also put Flight of the Conchords in that category?
You could.
Okay.
You could. I always think of that as more of a...
He's giving a half-scrunch face.
Sitcom that has some music in
Fair
it.
Fair enough. Okay. So anyway, if anything else, I think My Favorite Year is definitely...
Oh, yeah.
Definitely worth watching anytime. But salute to Joseph Bologna with that. All right. Because of the time, and by the way, Mike, I always appreciate you hanging out here.
Oh,
shorter time this time. We'll make it a full show next time,
oh, that's okay.
I hope. He's a busy man. All right. Because of the passing of Glenn Campbell, I'm going to replay a chat I did, I believe it was January of 2015, with actor-director James Keach. Yes, I did talk about the Glenn Campbell documentary, I'll Be Me, but I did get some questions in about the Long Riders, which is always worth it. But at the time, he was still looking for funding to get the documentary out to more film festivals. So I got to have studio time with him in this very studio before he had a huge meeting with Eli Lilly. I don't know
way
how
to sneak in under the door. There,
I don't know how it went. I think it did well because it got an Academy Award nomination. Ladies and gentlemen, to talk about Glenn Campbell, my interview with James Keach. So, James, why are you in Indianapolis? Besides promoting the film?
Indianapolis. We're in Indianapolis promoting the film to meet with Eli Lilly about potential sponsorship for the film throughout the world.
I'm really glad you made the film. It's really well done. Really enjoyed it. And it gives a warts and all look of what Glenn has had to go through. When did you start filming, and how long did it take?
We started filming in the summer of 2011, thinking it was going to be a 5.5-week tour, it turned out to be in a 2.5-year shoot, 151 shows. The reason being is when Glenn first came out and said that he had Alzheimer's and that he was going to go out and tour, he had very few bookings, and I think most people were very fearful that this was going to be a train wreck. And as soon as the audiences saw it, they realized that this was one of the most inspiring things that anybody had ever seen. And the bookings just continued to grow, and so did the reviews. The reviews were very, very positive. And That's how it ended to be 2.5 years. So I should say that we thought that we would be only doing it for 5.5 weeks, and we're kind of relieved at the thought of doing it because we couldn't figure out a way to make a show that was going to be uplifting and positive about a guy with Alzheimer's. The producer of his last two albums was a very good friend of mine, and he kept saying, "Come on, James, you've been shooting rock shows for a while. You have all the equipment. Come on, just do it. Just record it for history." Well, we did record it for history, but it also, in doing that, changed our life, changed my life personally, completely, actually. As a filmmaker and as a guy who was very, very much afraid of what Alzheimer's is and what it might do to somebody, to being an advocate for really wanting to change the conversation about it and to really inform the world as to what we're up against and to let people see what a hero Glenn Campbell is.
Now, you said the producer, record producer, was that how you got involved with the project?
Julian Raymond. Mm-hmm. Julian Raymond who produced Glenn Campbell, I'll Be Me, and Ghost on a Canvas. Was producing my son Johnny, who was 13 at the time, was producing his music and kept coming into the studio and saying, "Come on, man, you got to meet Glenn." Because I'd made a movie a few years before called Walk the Line.
Yep.
And produced it, and he said, "You know, we got to do something about Glenn before it's too late." And I didn't know what too late was in the early parts of our conversation. Too late, of course, turned out to be Alzheimer's. And I said to Julian and my partner Trevor Albert, we both said to him, "Look, we made that movie. We did the biopic, and it's not that Glenn's not an incredible story. It's just that, you kind of want to try and work on other kinds of pictures, you know." And "You got to meet him. You got to meet him." This went on for 6 months. Finally, he said, "He's going to tell the world he's got Alzheimer's. He's going to do a very short tour. Will you meet him, please?" So we said, "Sure, we'll meet him." And Glenn, when he came over, by the way, over the weekend beforehand, we watched everything we could about Alzheimer's, and everything we saw was so, so depressing. It always showed people at the end stages of it, or the scientific version of it. Except in The Notebook, which was a beautiful, beautiful film, I thought. Mm-hmm. But it didn't. There weren't documentaries that showed it. And then we met Glenn. Glenn comes into the house, and he's with his beautiful wife Kim, and And Johnny's walking across the living room and has his guitar in his hand. And he goes, hey, I play guitar. And Johnny goes, yes, sir, I know you play guitar. He says, you want me to show you something? And Johnny says, sure. And he picks up the guitar and he just shreds it. And he said, that's what Uncle Boo taught me. You practice that, you'll be good. And then Johnny walked into his bedroom and took his guitar, and Glenn looked at Kim, and he said, you know what? A man findeth a good woman, he findeth a good thing. I found me a good thing. That's my thing. And he's talking to Kim, and she said, and then Kim said to me, James, you know, Glenn's got Alzheimer's, and we want you to film this. And he says, what? I got what? He said, you got Alzheimer's. He says, no, I don't. I got part-timers. So you got it right up front. Here was the guy who's in love with his wife, who's an incredible musician, who wasn't afraid to talk about what was going on in his life. Oh, and here comes Johnny walking back across the living room. And Glenn looks over at him and says, hey, I play guitar. You want me to show you something? So we got to see the whole thing right there, like in a period of 5 minutes.
A natural pitch.
And it was just like, wow, this guy is so, he's funny, he's self-deprecating, he's engaging, he's and that's what he is in the film. And so just felt that 5 weeks, that's what Kim says, it's only 5 weeks. You know, it's going to be 5 weeks, you know. Okay. And so here we are 4 years later, I'm still talking about it, and the film is just now beginning its journey out into the world. That we were in 80 cities and did probably, I don't know, it's the best reviewed film I've ever made. And if you could imagine a song in the movie called I'm Not Going to Miss You, and it's the last song, was nominated for an Academy Award. Now, if you can imagine a guy 76 years old with Alzheimer's nominated for an Academy Award and 3 Grammys and the broadcast critics thing, and I mean, it's just like, who would have ever thought? That's not why we got into it. What I'm saying is that when Glenn Campbell said, I ain't done yet, and he was told to hang up his guitar, and here's a guy that, you know, we all, when, you know, given some terrible diagnosis of whatever, Alzheimer's, cancer, heart disease, whatever, a lot of us just go, okay, poor me, and go sit on the pity pot, and that's the end of it. Instead, he said, nope, I'm going to keep playing until I can't play anymore. And in so doing, what he's doing is he's shown the world a way to, the Alzheimer's, he's shown the world a way to live, and his family, the caregiving. It's a beautiful, beautiful tribute to a family. And for me, as a film, I don't know.
You got it.
Yeah, and I got to do it.
Yeah.
You know, which is 1,400 hours of film, I got to do it. Yeah.
So you had not met him before this?
No, I didn't. I had not. They knew of me because of John Cash, and they knew people obviously that knew John Cash, and John Cash was a dear friend of my wife's and mine, and was the godfather of my kids, and he asked me to make that movie. So,
well, I say the amount of footage, and I know you said you shot 1,400, but the amount of footage, warts and all, ups and downs. I wondered if you had known him, because the amount of the access that you were able to get, you know, backstage at home. So the fact that you didn't, I mean, I think that's something to be said about you as a filmmaker, as well as capturing it with the camera.
Well, you know, I think it is something to be said about me as a filmmaker, maybe as a person. I love to talk to people. I like asking questions more than I like talking about, you know, myself. I like sharing stories of people's lives. I'm very interested in where people come from. And Glenn and I and John Cash, we all shared one similar thing. And that is, I didn't have to. All my friends when I was growing up, a little small town in Texas, they picked cotton because that's what they had to do. And I picked cotton because they did, and I wanted to go do it. So I always knew where they came from, these guys, you know, from the cotton fields and struggles with substances there was always an honesty about our conversations. And I think when I said to the family, I said, look, I'm not going to put anything in this film that I wouldn't say about my own dad. And, you know, after a period of time, at first people were reluctant. All the people on the crew, they'd look at you and they'd go, who is this guy? And then, you know, you spend enough time with somebody and you get to know their character. And that's the interesting thing about, for me, going from narrative film to documentary film, is that in narrative film you write the script, and of course the actors, when they're really, the performances are great, they trust you like the families do in the documentaries. They start trusting when you see something nuance that, you know, you say, you know, that's really good, but maybe let's try it a little different. And they trust that you're not trying to manipulate them into something that you want to see. If you're really good, they're trusting that you want to bring the best out in them, which is a big difference, mm-hmm. you know? And I think the Campbells, they wanted to tell the true story, but they also, dignity was something very important. And I was there to help take care of Glenn. Trevor and I, we became part of the caregiving group. We would take Glenn when you know, he was having a problem or he was lost somewhere. We'd go find him, and, you know, we were there all the time. So it became a very different experience, and that's what I mean, because I've become an advocate. I now understand what caregiving is about, mm-hmm. and the role of the caregiver, and how this is just, it's so important that people understand this. And we did a screening in Nashville for 4,000 people at one time, and then we did a concert afterwards. And I was the MC of the show, and the band Perry was playing, and Ashley Campbell and Delta Ray. There was the three bands that were playing after the screening. And I, to cover the time of setting up, I said to the audience, how many people in this audience, I'm just curious, how many people have been touched by Alzheimer's and or caregiving or somebody who knows it? And 4,000 people stood up. And I went, and how many of you actually talk to other people about it? And almost all of them sat down. Because there's a whole shame connected with it. There's a whole, you know, embarrassment. There's the, you know, and that's what Glenn's doing. Right? He's showing us, you don't have to hide. We can understand it. We can have compassion for people who have this. And one of the things that was so moving and important to me in as a human being in making the film and really reinforced my faith in humanity was that the audience, when he would play, instead of being judgmental and when he would forget a line or something like that, they cheered him on.
Mm-hmm.
They gave him standing ovation after standing ovation for his courage. And I will say that in between, you know, when he messed something up and then he'd get it back, and when he'd get it back, he'd get it back in spades. He'd just kill it. I mean, he's still a genius musician. But it was still that spirit of and that's why it was, seeing the show was so cool, because it was like an experience. It was you don't know what's going to happen next. It's like a movie where you sit on the edge of your seat and you don't know what's going to happen. Is he going to, is the teleprompter going to break down? Mm-hmm. Or is he going to play in the wrong key, which he did some nights, and the kids had, they learned how to really be good musicians, because he would play, he'd start in the wrong key and he would not come out of it. And so now they had to switch.
They had to adjust.
Exactly. So.
Well, it's funny you mentioned, because, you know, Glenn did a show in Carmel, which is just north of here, and I think it was a couple of weeks before it became known, before he went public with Alzheimer's. And, of course, the reviews were saying that the performance was erratic and, you know, he'd start, he'd repeat. So, you know, obviously a couple of weeks later, we finally got the explanation as to why. But yeah, you said, watching the show, because I remember this, I think there's a part where his wife says, you know, here's your teleprompter, here's your mark. And as an audience member, when you would see him veer right or veer left, you kind of tense up a little bit and like, oh, I hope he's all right. Hope he makes it. And yeah, and you were able to show sometimes he did and sometimes he didn't.
Right. That makes for good drama, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
That's right. That's one of the things that was so exciting about it. And I was always on stage right. I had his close-up camera. So that was the other thing about, you know, going from there. Usually, you have Conrad Hall shooting the movie when you're making, you know, something like that. Instead, it's James Keach. And the other guys were all shooting cameras, and it was really, it was really exciting, you know. And one night, Glenn, at Carnegie Hall, he walked over to me, and he walked right into this giant close-up, and he goes, "Hey, like a rhinestone cowboy," and he puts the mic right in my mouth, and he wants me to sing it with me, and I said, "Stop it, stop that," you know, and I had to do it. I did it in the audience chair. It was fun.
I was wondering, you mentioned how often did he notice the camera whether it was in studio or at home?
He would notice it sometimes. He liked it. You know, he's one of those guys, it's probably like you with that microphone. You like having it in front of you. You feel good because this is your world. Mm-hmm. Glenn's world was being on that stage, and he liked, he wanted to make the movie. He wanted us to be around. And he'd forget it. He'd forget that we were there. One of the most moving moments for me filming was at the Mayo Clinic. And they would only allow one camera in, and that was me. Mm-hmm. And they're injecting him with dye to do a PET scan of his brain, and he's there, and he wondered where I was right at the beginning. And then he forgot I was even there because I set up two cameras and I let one roll for a wide shot over here, and I had a close up camera straight on him, and I was pretty far back. Because I like to use longer lenses. I didn't ever want to get too close to him because I didn't want him to be conscious of me being there. And he just starts singing to Kim, and they go into their own world. And he trusted me as a person, so he always knew that if I was in the room, everything was okay. Somehow that if I was nearby, that he kept him calm. So the camera became a friend to him, his friend. Mm-hmm. I don't think he noticed the camera. He never played to it. He certainly never ever did things for the camera for performance.
And I also wondered if depending on what day he had of him wondering what are these people doing in my house because of the Alzheimer's. That never happened?
Well, a lot of times what we would do with the cameras there is we would set them up and we'd walk away.
Okay.
Yeah, or Kim would set them up and walk away, mm-hmm. You know, and it was just there. And then we would go through the footage.
You mentioned how funny he is, and I think a lot of people forget that. I mean, the guy had a variety show at one time, so we know the musicality, but yeah, seeing him working with his family, especially with his family on the road, and yeah, even talking with doctors, he's just a sunlight.
He is, you know, he said it in the film, "I've laughed and I've cried, it's hell of a lot better to laugh." And he loved Roger Miller, and he would always tell jokes. He always wanted you to smile, you know. Mm-hmm. And he still does like people. You go visit with Glenn now, and you don't know what he's laughing about, but he's laughing about something, and he starts laughing so hard that he gets everybody else laughing. You know, mm-hmm. He's just an amazing, special, honest guy. That's the other thing that he would say things in his Alzheimer's repetitiveness that were very important to him. Like when a man findeth a good woman, talk about Kim. He has very deep belief, very deep faith. And he would also always talk about the importance of telling the truth. You know, and how lying's no good. And then he would talk about drugs. And if there was ever an anti-drug guy, it was him. About how it really messed his life up for a short period of time. But that short period of time, you know, was magnified into a real media thing. And I think the alcohol thing was, I think the alcohol was to self-medicate his, the beginnings of his Alzheimer's, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, all this stuff, all the drugs and substance abuse and everything, it's to deal with the pain that comes from so far back in all our lives, you know, and we're trying to self-medicate the pain. I think that's just my opinion. You know, when Glenn would talk about his growing up and how tough it was where he came from, and same thing with John Cash. It was tough, man. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure many, many people in this country, it's really tough.
Now, not really giving away anything, but we do get to see the final concert. And I know the tour was hit. I mean, they ended the tour on the right note. I guess it was
Napa.
Right. And I guess it was best to finish it here and get out while the getting is good, I guess. Was that your original intent, or was that their original intent? It was just covering the tour and then that's it?
The original intent, first of all, the original intent was 5.5 weeks.
Right, well, yes.
So 2.5 years later, you know, millions of dollars later, oh my gosh, you know, and maybe someday we'll get it back. But that's not the important thing. The important thing is that the world see the film. And I think for your audience that I can promise them that they will be uplifted, and it's funny. There's more big laughs in this movie than there are in major comedies. I mean, it's funny. He is so funny. Your question is, was that the intent to end it here? That was the last book show of that year. And we all felt that Glenn wasn't enjoying it as much. It was agitating him. Mm. And yet the night before that show might have been his best show. That's the thing that's so amazing about this thing. And he was still good that night. He's still, you know, Southern Nights, the song he ends with is beautiful. And it's just that, you know, he wasn't enjoying it as much, and it was getting him agitated and stressed out and disoriented. So the whole idea was not to do the show because we had to do the show because there was a need to make money or anything. It was to prolong Glenn's health. That's ultimately the idea, is to give him the opportunity to do what he loves the most. And because we believe, and I think the doctors that have seen the film since subsequently, that this really prolonged his journey as a musician and as a human being, because soon after we stopped, even though the last song was done several months later, I filmed that several months later with the Wrecking Crew, he went downhill pretty fast after the tour was over. I mean, we'd go and play little clubs here and there. We'd bring musicians over. One night we went to see Merle Haggard and Toby Keith was there, and we went out to the bus and played, which is really cool. And he could still just kill it, you know. But, you know, it's, I don't know. Alzheimer's is a tricky thing, man. It breaks your heart. It breaks your heart when you, it breaks the hearts of the people that are around the people more than it breaks the hearts of the people that are suffering from it, at least in the end stages. Mm-hmm. In the beginning stages, when you know you have it and you're facing it, you know, it's not easy.
Well, and shifting gears a little bit, congratulations on the film getting a nomination for the song. I know will you be at the Oscars?
I hope so, yeah, I will. I will. I'm a member of the Academy, so I'll be there. But it got nominated for 3 Grammys, too.
Yes, congrats on that as well.
Which I just think is, you know, it got nominated for Best Video for the Country Music Association. So, you know, I am not a spring chicken, and this is my first music video. So it's never too late. It's never too late. You can go out there and make your music video. I tell you right now.
Well, I'm not going to ask your age, but I do love directors with a 6, a 7, and an 8 in their age still making work. Still, I mean, I play jazz and blues musicians that are in their 90s, still putting out product, still putting out work.
That's so good, man.
Absolutely,
hey, man. You know, I mean, listen. Look at Clint. I did a movie with Clint with Robert Duvall.
Stars Fall on Henrietta.
Yeah, right. And I'll never forget Clint. I said, "Do you have one note for me, Clint?" He said, "Yeah. If you got the shot, move the camera." Meaning, don't do the same take twice, which is really interesting because he's so sparse, you know, in what he does. And here's the absurdity of the Academy. Here's a guy. This is maybe his best film in many, many, many years, and he's not nominated. You know? I mean, come on, guys. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, it's this, there's such politics in all these organizations. You know, if you're not a member of the doc branch, you're not a member of the little club, you know, you're a member of the narrative branch, you know, it's if you're not a member of the narrative branch, you know, and you're a member of the doc branch, it's just, you know, it's human nature, you know, we're all in our little cliques and, you know, but Clint's work is remarkable.
Two films in one year.
Yeah. And one of which I did not care for at all. And I wondered, what the heck did you do that for? You know, and although there was some good stuff in it, but I guess he did it because he wanted to. And that he loved that period of music because he loves music.
Yep.
You know, and it wasn't a bad film. I mean, well, I like the play better. How's that?
Sure. That's all right.
I enjoyed the play more. But, you know, for those people who never knew who those guys were, the Jersey Boys, and the kids that are growing up, your kids, my kids.
It's a good 101.
Yeah, it is. It's a good thing for them to see, and it'll live, and it'll be fine. So, but that compared to American Sniper, my God.
Mm-hmm. And I think he's been able to, I mean, you know, he retired the tough guy. He retired his Western persona with Unforgiven. He retired his tough guy persona with Gran Torino. And he's been able to direct anything he wants, whether it's Jersey Boys or American Sniper or Bridges in Madison County or Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. You know, to be able to direct what you want and have a studio backing you on that, that's rare.
Yeah, you got to be named Clint Eastwood.
Now, you said you'd filmed concert footage before. Who else have you shot?
I went out with Cheap Trick.
Yeah?
Yeah, Johnny, the kid opened for Cheap Trick for a few, for 2 years. So that's what we were doing. Cool. It was fun.
So, and between your film and Still Alice, there is a lot, you know, people are talking more about Alzheimer's. Have you been approached by a lot of people, whether it's on the street or at festivals? You know, you mentioned the Nashville event. Has that become almost a daily occurrence now?
We have requests for around 300 screenings, and it's just going to grow exponentially, I think. And, you know, we were reading yesterday in China, the number is staggering, how many people have it. So I think the long tail of this movie is going to be great. And I think, too, that the thing that's exceptional about it is that there's music in it. It makes it so palpable because, you know, you get to see a guy play his music, and it's good music. And the Still Alice movie and Julianne Moore's performance is really good. There's no question about it. There's not a lot of laughs, and it's a narrative linear progression from you got it to you're out of it, and Glenn is the difference. Of course, is one is real and one is imagined, and I think we screened it here actually at Lilly a few weeks ago, and the head of their Japanese global marketing division saw it, and she wants to take it to Japan, and so take it to Australia, and it's a huge problem in China. And the thing that's cool about it is that it's a very entertaining film. So if you can entertain people, inform them, empower them, inspire them, get them to want to make a change, we got a shot at slowing this sucker down, because we need everybody to. We need financial support to do it, you know. And I think that most people have perceived this as being an old person's thing, and it's not. The people that are going to suffer the most from it are the young people, because they're going to have to take care of the old people. It's going to break the economy, which is a frightening thing, you know. I mean, just to talk realistically, 2050 it'll exceed the national. At 2025, it'll exceed the national defense budget. 2050, you'll start breaking the economy.
You said it took 2.5 years. What did you do in between? I mean, did you have pockets of time where you were able to work on other projects, or were
not
you just
really
kind of on standby?
No, not really. This has been my life for a while.
Well, it's not just Steve James who has the multi-year commitments when it comes to making documentaries. You are now a part of that club. So
yeah.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
If I may, I wanted to shift gears a little bit. I want to personally thank you for creating The Long Riders.
Ah, good.
I got to see that with my dad when it came out. Where did that start? Where did telling the story of the James family come about for you?
My brother and I did a movie called Orville and Wilbur.
Yep.
We played the Wright brothers. And so we thought, let's play the wrong brothers. So Stacy and I, you know, he's 7 years older, and at the time he was just starting to really ascend as a movie star. I went off and I was into music, and I said, we'll try and write it as a country western musical. We did it as the Bandit Kings. And so we made a musical about the James Gang. I just thought it would be cool because it was the time Keith was doing Hair and Keith Carradine, and you know, there was a lot of musicals being done, and Godspell, and it was a cool time in the theater in New York. And so we started to do that, and then
But when he says the James Gang, he doesn't mean the group with Joe Walsh. That's another group.
Yeah, this is the Jesse James
the
Gang.
The actual James Gang.
Jesse James, Cole Younger, you know, the Miller Brothers, yeah. So we did it for a while, and we played it at the Bowery Lane Theater, and it was fun. And then we said, let's try and develop it into a movie. So we took the script and wrote the script, and then I was doing a film in Bora Bora with Tim Zinnemann. And Tim Zinnemann had done a movie with Walter Hill, and he said, "What are you working on all the time?" And I said, "I'm working on this." And he said, "Let me read it." And he said, "You know who'd like this is Walter Hill." So he said, "Can you get all those guys?" And I said, "I don't know. Yeah, I think we can." So Keith was doing an album, and so we went to the record plant. It's burned down now. The record plant in Hollywood, and we got the Bridges brothers, the Carradine brothers, the Keats brothers, and we all went out into the alley. It was like 2 a.m, and we took a picture of all of us together, and we sent it to them, and that began the journey. The Bridges brothers eventually weren't able to do it, and it became the Guest brothers, Chris and Nick Guest. And the Quaids were in the picture too, Randy and Dennis Quaid. So that original script, we wrote the original script, and Walter came in and did a rewrite on the script. We did a rewrite on that script, and then we went and we made it, and it was awesome.
Where'd you shoot it?
We shot it in Clayton, Georgia, Albany, Georgia, Texas, and Sonora, California, where they had the trains, where they did single gauge trains.
Besides the brothers casting, which I think is a great marketing tool, not a gimmick, but I also read that Walter Hill and wanted to have a family feel on the film, and obviously that paid off not only with your brothers, but the film also humanizes these characters that we kind of grew up knowing as being notorious bad guys, and then seeing them at home chopping wood, dealing with the women in their lives. You know, that seemed more interesting than just black hats versus white hats.
Well, that's what it was. You know, it was like, you know, when Jesse's mother was and his brother was tortured, and they were, you know, you understood why they did what they did. You know, why they were so upset about everything, and why, you know, they went after the Pinkertons. One of the things about wars that we don't understand is we see all the people running down the streets. You know, the Iranians, the Iraqis. We don't to have compassion for the fact that they, you know, those kids are born and they're nurtured and they're loved and they're, you know, we dehumanize them in some way, and which is sad. And in this case, the James Gang, this was a family, and they were wronged. In my opinion, they were wronged by the North. They were, you know, and they took it upon themselves, rightly or wrongly, to seek revenge for it, you know.
Now, how was it working with Walter Hill as a director, and did he later influence you as a director?
I love Walter. Walter, here's Walter. I love telling this story. I can tell it now, years later. So we're out in front of McCorkindale Barn, and there's a big shootout. And on the, you know, in those days, they probably still do, the barn, they would squib the barn. They put squibs, they put M13s or whatever things in the barn. And they would blow holes in it to appear as if bullet holes were coming through so that you get, and then they'd backlight it so that the light would come flashing through and you'd see all these holes in the barn. So I'm out there with a rifle and I'm shooting in front of the barn and we're, there's this whole thing going on, you know, big raid. And it's about three of these M13s blow up and they hit me in the back. And it blows holes literally in my back, you know, and blood and my knees buckle because I'm just,
right.
It's not like I can't hold myself up. I've been hit and I'm going down on the ground and I'm shooting. It's in slow motion and it's cool. And I hear Walter go, God, Keith, damn it. If you ever do that again, I'll bullwhip you. What are you talking about? They're carrying me off to the hospital. Said, you can't fall down like that. You're Jesse James. Walter, you know, I had stitches in my back and everything. He was funny. He always appeared to be a tough guy. He was John Ford's second assistant director. So, you know, and
survived Peckinpah as well.
Right, he survived Peckinpah, and he liked to wear the eye patch and all that stuff, you know. And but he's a terrific filmmaker and a good guy. And, you know, he liked making those tough guy movies. He was good at it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It also makes me want to have Ry Cooter provide the soundtrack of my life.
Ry Cooter's pretty darn good.
Pretty good.
Pretty darn
Not
good.
Not bad at all.
Not bad at all.
So, as you said, you're 7 years younger than Stacey. What's it like to direct your brother?
Well, now he asks me to direct him in lots of movies. For many years, he was like, hey, kid, you know. So now I think he figures I've proved myself as a filmmaker. But it's actually his... He was directing. The reason I wanted to become a director was because of him. He was doing a movie, down in Alabama, about an Alabama prison, and he was doing a little documentary. And I came into the editing room and I would watch him cut it, and it was just so fascinating to me how films were put together. I loved it, so I really fell in love with the whole idea of it. And I still am in love with it. It's still magic to me.
Mm-hmm.
Still 90 minutes in the dark is magic. Going to the movies and making movies is it's the coolest thing you can do.
What are you working on next?
You know, it's interesting. We've developed a lot of narrative scripts, but I am leaning towards making documentaries. During the period of this film, because of the caregiver and all the stuff that caregivers go through, we started talking to people who've been connected with the military with post-traumatic stress syndrome. And it's fascinating to talk to them about the moral injury that takes place when you have to do things like in war that you shouldn't do, that goes against your conscience. And caregiving, and when you're dealing with people with health, the problems that you have. So there's something very interesting to me about that moral injury thing that takes place in all of us that causes addiction, that causes pain, that causes. So I'm kind of intrigued to look at that area and to try and find to make a movie kind of like Glenn's movie that's inspirational, but that will allow people to see and to have empathy for people who have to, like soldiers who do things like this and what they go through and how we can help them, and people who are caregivers, how we can help them and how we can help ourselves, heal ourselves. So I suppose that's something that's an area that I'm interested in. And I don't know, I think there's a lot to be said about it, and I think there's not a lot said about it.
And now that you have a title of director of an Academy Award-nominated documentary, that will hopefully get a little more incentive.
I don't know. I hope so.
Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed.
Silent Green is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. Also, Indie Fringe is happening. Go to IndieFringe.org for locations and times. But definitely, don't miss Mike and Ronnie, A Love Story, St. Harley, Adventure Girl, The Gab, Drink Spear, Woody Said, Canvas, and The Art of the Jewish Joke. So go see a good movie or go see a Fringe show. You deserve it. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, Michigan.
No, that's not what I said.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
I think it's overrated.
Shut up, you!
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!